to Bending the Arc. Bending the Arc is an offering of the Shasta Equal Justice Coalition and offered here on KKRN Community Supported Radio. We are in conversations, as you know, with a range of people working for equal justice in and from outside of the criminal legal system. And today I have the pleasure of speaking with someone that I met when he came to speak to Civil Shasta, I believe it was, Jason Bryant from Creating Restorative Opportunities and Programs, or CROP. Welcome, Jason.
Thank you, Sharon. Thank you.
So people who listen to the show know that I like to give people an opportunity to introduce themselves in whatever is important to them and helps ground our conversation.
Okay. So, I am from Shasta County. Mm-hmm. My parents and I lived out in Happy Valley, and I actually attended West Valley High School. I had come to that town with a series of like limiting negative beliefs about what it meant to be a young man, which developed into criminal behaviors over time. And in the year of 1999, myself and two co-defendants perpetrated several robberies in Shasta County, the last of which resulted in a man's murder of his own home. I was sentenced to 26 years to life in prison at 20 years old for my crimes, for my involvement in the crime. And I had some incredible challenges and incredible transformations over the course of 20 years of incarceration, which I'd be happy to share with you through this conversation, if requested. But here we are, you know, almost 30 years later, and, you know, I have dedicated my life to living in amends for the damage I caused to my victims, to my community, to my family, to myself. And so I'm working with CROP today to help create a better pathway for people coming home so they can step into opportunities to be contributing members of society versus people that are taking from it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, and when you came, I think as we talk about some of the challenges that are common, you know, commonly face people who are coming back to society, those challenges may come up, because I think it's, you know, here at the SEJC, it's really important to understand what are some of the barriers to coming back successfully, what groups like ours can do to make those transitions successful. So thank you for sharing that. And it was good to know in your talk, you know, that you understand Shasta County. You've had a lot of different experiences here, so that's also important. Maybe we could begin then with what you have seen that people understand and don't understand about what it takes to transition successfully.
Okay. Maybe I could start a little bit earlier and talk about like the experience of incarceration itself.
Sure, sure.
So, you know, I do want to say this, like, as someone who is formerly incarcerated, I am a strong advocate for personal responsibility and accountability. Mm-hmm. When people make choices, and when people make poor choices, harmful choices, I do believe that there should be a level of accountability for it. Mm-hmm. On the individual. Simultaneously, I believe that society has a responsibility to have some accountability as well. One, in like, what context are we creating as a community that makes this type of thinking seem like a good choice? And two, when people do make these choices, how are we holding them in a space where rehabilitation is possible, or punishing them, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Historically, our country has largely enacted a punishment model for incarceration. So you do something wrong, you're going to prison. And when you're in prison, you're largely going to be treated as a second-class citizen. You're relegated to the term of an inmate and given a number. When I went to prison in 1999, this was the height of the tough on crime movement. I had a life sentence in prison, even though I had never had any interaction with law enforcement prior to this. I'm not saying I was a choir boy. I was just lucky enough not to get caught for some of the dumb stuff I was doing. But, 20 years old with a life sentence in prison, it was a pretty public decree by the then governor that the only way someone with a life sentence would ever get out of prison was in a pine box. So, you couple that messaging with a significant lack of programs inside for people, like no opportunities for training, education beyond GED. Or programs that can really help people get their head on right. It's ripe for a context of despair. And that's what I went into in 1999, 2000. It was, maximum security institution in Susanville, California, where there was nothing to look forward to for people. And, things have changed, thankfully. They've introduced something called the California model now through Governor Newsom. So there is some funds going into prisons for programming. But I want to say that that was a long process and it still is. There's a lot of work to be done. One of the things that I've noticed to be true, that the general perspective of many people in society is that when someone commits a crime, they should be punished not only in prison, but once they're released as well.
Mm-hmm.
The reality is that today people are still paroling from prison with $200 gate money. That amount of funds to get going in life has not changed in over 40 years.
In over 4 years, you said?
40.
40. That's, I was wondering if you had said 40. I thought that's not possible, but yeah.
Yeah, 40 years. And basically they're given gate money and told figure it out. And then they, people return to their communities or, what have you. And they experience a lot of closed doors. A significant number of barriers on procuring housing, on getting gainful employment, receiving any type of training, largely because of the stigma that comes with having a criminal conviction. Some of the thinking is can't be trusted, I'm not safe around them. And those ideas significantly impact laws that, old laws on the book about people that have felonies, not being allowed to work here, not being allowed to do this. And employers, housing providers often buy into that. So it's very challenging for people coming out of incarceration if you don't have support to find a way forward.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned, I was going to ask you later, that there have been changes. I know we have people here locally who have been advocating for more changes in programming, here in Shasta County. And of course, there are other, factors that are barriers to that. But what kinds of changes are you seeing and what further changes are most needed?
So I can say this, historically, when I was in prison, today, the number is $132,000 a year per person that taxpayers pay to keep someone in prison. Per person, right? And of that $132,000, less than 2% of that money was going towards their rehabilitation.
Mm.
So that's revealing. And I mean, with such a small amount invested in someone actually coming out of prison, rehabilitated. And the reality is that over 90% of people are coming home. What are we doing? What are we putting our money into? Right.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to be our neighbors. Just what type of neighbors are they going to be? So some of the most recent changes, they've had things Prop 37, different bills that have come across for three strikers, but the most recent one is the California model introduced by Governor Newsom, which is in many ways, it's a parallel to the Norwegian model. So in Norway, just to give a little context there, in Norway, there is an abundance of programming for the incarcerated population. And again, the thinking behind it, the rationale behind it is that, yes, when people make poor choices that are harmful to the community, they need to be held accountable. But society has some responsibility in this. Like it's our society. We created a context that made these decisions seem like good ones. So therefore, it's our responsibility to provide programming that re-educate and reintegrate them as quickly as possible, because these are our citizens. They don't belong in cages. They belong home, right? Mm-hmm. So the California model, as I said, is modeling the Norwegian model, where it's taking some of that money per person and increasing the percentage that's going to rehabilitation with programming inside, training, self-development, things of that nature, to really equip people with different opportunities when they're released.
Mm-hmm. And when we're talking rehabilitation, are we grouping like everything related to education, training, mental health, substance abuse, counseling, all of that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, you know, there's oftentimes people are going into incarceration with an abundance of challenges, whether it's substance abuse, whether it's criminal thinking, whether it's lack of like training or education, and rehabilitation really encompasses all of that. Like, what does this person need in terms of support to re-enter society and be contributing in a meaningful way?
Yeah, I know in California, there's been connections with community colleges and universities about, you know, more education programs, and it still can take a lot to get those started and going. I know that you have some in-custody programs as well. And maybe we could just talk about those before we talk about all the things that you're doing to help, you know, transition once people are out.
Sure. So CROP started in prison. Myself and one of my co-defendants, he's actually the founder of CROP organization. Him and his father founded it in 2008. And then Providence brought him and I together in 2010 at a different institution, which is uncanny. There's like 30, at the time there was like 34 institutions, and we started at the same prison. We ended up at the same prison. And he approached me and he said, you know, me and my dad started this nonprofit, and I think there's an opportunity for us to work together and create some positive change inside of prison. Initially CROP was started to like break up the antisocial race-based like violence and dispositions inside of prison, through the introduction of like music equipment and sports equipment, because my co-defendant knew that it's hard to hate somebody that you're in a band with or who you play sports with, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Interaction. Yeah.
Yep. So, but by the time we reconnected in 2010, there was a new vision. CROP was willing to support us in building a program inside where we could actually receive education and train incarcerated individuals in becoming alcohol and other drug counselors. So we over the course of 3 years, we certified 33 life term individuals. Of those 33, 32 have paroled. None have gone back. They're all doing wonderful work in the community, giving back in substantial ways. Then we went on to deliver personal leadership training to close to 1,000 incarcerated individuals over the next 7 years, approximately. So just having conversations with individuals about, you know, living in alignment with what they say is most important, like getting authentic with themselves, because you can go to any prison yard and people with like the most distorted thinking and say like, what's most important to you? They typically won't say, you know, my gang, you know, my reputation. They'll say things like my freedom, my family, God, in many instances. And our work was about helping them come into alignment with that. So really most important, how are you making decisions today that are helping you to reunify with those things or to come closer to those things? Mm-hmm. So we did that for many years. We worked with college students who were coming in from the Salinas Valley to receive seminar training from us. And then we started a scholarship where the incarcerated population who at the time made between 8 and 11 cents an hour, raised a little over $32,000 to support one young disadvantaged youth in attending college preparatory school. So those are some of the programs we were doing inside along the way, you know, obviously working on our own rehabilitation. In 20 years, I earned a bachelor's degree, two master's degrees, and became a state certified alcohol and other drug counselor. Awesome. You know, that pales in comparison to the impact that we were able to create for the people inside, and, you know, help to positively impact and transform the culture of that prison, as well as people outside of the prison. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, you know, there are two things that strike me when you say that. One is, you know, connecting people with their values. And, you know, I know people that I work with that are not incarcerated, that identification of what those values are, there's a whole process there as well, that some people haven't had the space or support to really think about that.
Sure.
I'm wondering about that. And I also wonder the people, those 32 who have left, who were paroled and are doing well, what you hear or have heard from them about what was most important to them that made that successful. Because training's a component, right? But there's sure. so much more than having the skills.
I think that, you know, most people, I want to say all people, I do, but people want to be a part of something that's good.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, the confluence of like distorted thinking patterns, limiting beliefs, criminal beliefs can get in the way of that. But at the heart of people, like, we want to be a part of something good. What we found to be most effective was building a community of people who were living authentically. And like when we would have the conversations with individuals about what was most important and they got it, like the light went off, then they too became a part of a movement to honor a purpose that was bigger than themselves. Like personal rehabilitation, it has to start with you. Like, you can't be good for anyone else until you're good for yourself. But then once you reach that level, even for the incarcerated population, if you like, true freedom is found in being of service to your community. That's something I discovered early on. My first 10 years of incarceration were largely about like me staying out of the way, not wanting to get in trouble, not wanting to hurt my family any further, but really focusing on me.
Mm-hmm.
My last 10 years of incarceration came with a recognition that true freedom came in me being of service to my community and working mm-hmm. alongside of others towards a purpose that was bigger than myself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's definitely something that, you know, to me is such a human need, both belonging and purpose, and really we can get out of a lot of ourselves through that service.
Yeah, for sure.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Bending the Arc on KKRN Community Supported Radio, and I am speaking with Jason Bryant of CROP, Creating Restorative Opportunities and Programs. So I wanted to make sure before we go any further that we also talk about what CROP does once folks transition out. And I'm going to read this from your website. It says, you know, CROP is providing formerly incarcerated individuals with full service reentry support and 12 months of intensive training to succeed in tech-focused careers. There's a lot there. There's a lot there to unpack. So I wanted to ask you, you know, a little bit about what your programs are and what that full service reentry support means to you.
Okay. So a little bit more history.
Sure. That'd be great.
So in 2020, all of our like incarcerated leadership had paroled. And now we were in a position where the question was like, not how do we run programs inside, but how do we run an organization and how do we add value? What we had was 80 years of like lived experience inside a prison and some great tools on how to help people get clear on what it would take for them to build a future worth having.
Among all your leadership.
Yeah, among our leadership, mm-hmm. like formerly incarcerated leaders, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it was COVID. Like COVID had just started in 2020. And, you know, you couldn't leave your house, much less go into a prison and talk about like personal development, personal leadership. a friend of ours who had paroled about a year before, he paroled to the Bay Area, and he noticed that there was an opportunity to contribute to the reentry space. Because what was easily observable was that much of the reentry landscape mirrored the same like disposition as prison itself, that it was built to punish, So
the whole parole process, parole
and like a lot of the service providers, in this sense that people were still being paroled with $200 gate money, being told to figure it out. If they needed housing support, they had to go talk to these folks and get on a waiting list, what have you. If they needed employment, they had to go try and find work with these people who, you know, might have been able to get them some employment in construction or working on the side of the road or driving a truck. Not that there's anything wrong with those things, but historically, people coming out of incarceration have been pathwayed into gig economy, sweat off your back type of labor, right? And one thing everyone had to do was report to your parole officer, or else you're going to be violated and go back to prison, right? So what made it punitive for folks was that no one was communicating with each other. No one was communicating or providing a holistic service that addressed the basic needs for people in society, like housing, like employment, like mental health services, like reentry guidance. So we sat around a table and we said, like, from our lived experience, after having, you know, now there's five of us, you know, over 100 years of incarceration, what is it that a person really needs to feel supported when they come out of incarceration? And that's where the inception of our Ready for Life program came from, which was a four-pillar model. And it came down to four things in our experience. Personal leadership development, helping people unpack the limiting beliefs, the negative beliefs they have about themselves and what's possible for their future. And within that part of the program, it's not only the personal development, but also digital literacy, because people who are incarcerated are severed from digital landscape. You know, the world is full of tech, and inside a prison, you don't have that exposure, as well as financial wellness. We knew that people needed to know how to manage money. That's one thing you don't have to do in prison, right? So that was the first thing, like leadership, how to think about your future in a meaningful way and take action towards creating it. Give them their digital literacy skills as well as the financial wellness. Second thing, training. So, you know, most jobs in prison, they do have some, they're introducing more opportunities for people, but historically most training is like, you know, the stereotypical license plate pressing or working in a kitchen or, you know, being a porter. We knew that people needed training in careers that offered them an opportunity to contribute to the thought economy as well. That could offer family sustaining wages, because the number one reason for criminal behavior and criminality is poverty.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So we need to provide them with training. The third pillar of the program was having conversations with employers, because you can give someone they can have the right mindset. They can have all the training for a career, but if employers don't understand the value of what we're calling, what we call fair chance talent, then they'll never have the opportunity. So we knew that we needed to have a pillar of a program where we were not only equipping our participants with like the employment readiness skills, such as resume development, how to do an interview, but we needed to engage employers themselves and say, look, this is the pipeline of talent that we have. It's oftentimes overlooked or marginalized because of stereotypes in society, but this is how we prepare them to actually contribute to your organization.
Mm-hmm.
Third pillar was, which is also the first pillar, is housing, because it's hard to do anything if you don't have a roof over your head. We knew that we wanted to provide people with a space where they could feel like they were being treated with dignity, you know, not warehoused with three people to a room, but they had some level of a dignified treatment in their space for a year, which could help them in their transition into a life of their own.
What are some of the components of leadership? That's a word, you know, we talk about a lot and gets thought of in different ways by different, you know, organizations or business. What are those aspects or qualities of leadership that are important in the work that CROP does?
So we have like central themes that we work with around personal leadership, but I can say, like, hands down, the most valuable element for us in perspective is that of personal responsibility. Mm-hmm. Personal responsibility. And, you know, to unpack that briefly, basically what we invite people to consider is that there's three things in our lives that we have direct control over. It's our attitudes, our choices, and our effort. And the personal responsibility conversation is inviting them to consider where in their lives they are looking out the window and casting blame for things that are not working out in their lives versus looking in the mirror and identifying contributions that they're making through their choices to affect results or outcomes. Because we have a general premise that if we're focusing on like our contributions, what are the choices I'm making from moment to moment, then we can be personally responsible for the outcomes that we're creating through the power of our choice. So that is the foundation of personal leadership in our program and in our methodology. And then we have a lot of other tools that we use to help people get clear about like the vision, like where do you see yourself 10 years from now? And if you were 10 years in the future, what decisions would you be making today to mm-hmm. make that into fruition? We have conversations about trust. How are we trusting people? Are we trusting them blindly? Where I'm giving you all of my trust, and then you know when you break it, I'm devastated. Or are we trusting people authentically, where we understand that we're human beings and we have a shared responsibility in the trust that's being issued? We have conversations about like how we're keeping our promises, how we're honoring our commitments, and how we're dealing with bitterness, right? Bitterness that we may be having, unforgiveness that we have in our life mm-hmm. That could be holding us back from achieving the future that we say we want for ourselves.
Mm-hmm. And lack of forgiveness for ourselves and others is that kind. Yeah,
absolutely.
That can be intense. For your full service reentry support, you're doing some case management. It's a year of housing. Like how important that is. I'm just acknowledging how important that is in terms of not having that daily worry while you're trying to get some of these other things on board. And other training opportunities during that year, correct?
Yeah. So, you know, we have several departments in terms of reentry, as you mentioned, like full service case management, mental health. Reentry also covers not only the housing component as far as people who are on like living on campus in our Oakland campus, but works with other providers to have offsite housing for people who are in the program. And they also conduct a credit building lending circle to help people who are in the program build their credit over the course of the year so they can qualify for a housing assistance program and a place of their own at the end of the program. So that's the bulk of what reentry does. Mm. And you have programs, which I oversee, that facilitates not only the personal leadership development, the digital literacy, the financial wellness, but also the instruction as far as the actual hard skills that people are taking to employers. Then we have, you know, the partnerships team that does the work and the engagement with employers, with our job developers to help help create the bridge between the hiring partner and our fellow.
Mm-hmm. And what are some of the tech focused careers that that you currently are focusing on?
So we're currently focusing on it's called software sales or B2B tech sales, and basically what we're teaching folks is how to interact with technology to sell technology. And we are currently we're doing a market analysis right now because we want to make sure that we are providing people with opportunities that move them as well. But also offer those family sustaining wages. So we're doing a market analysis to see if we may be expanding some of our offerings to other fields.
You mentioned you have an Oakland office, and I think I saw some photos when I was going on your website, which we'll put in our notes. What is there? How large is it? And how did it come about? And I welcome any history about that as well.
But the history on them. Yeah. So, I mean,
Huge. That's huge. I mean, any place in Oakland, right, is huge for the whole campus.
So for the listeners who don't know, in 2021, we partnered with the state of California and received a grant for $28.5 million to run a 3-year pilot. And part of that funding was to identify and procure housing in the Bay Area. So as you mentioned, like getting property in the Bay Area is very hard. And our then executive director, she's now the president of the organization, Tara Lawyer, worked with our leadership team to identify this property in West Oakland. It's 9 townhouses, 4 stories high, each of them. We utilize 3 of the townhouses for administration and training, and the other 5 are for residential support. So people live there and they go to training there.
Hmm. And when I heard you, I think it's when I heard you speak when you were here in Shasta County, you mentioned the neighbors and kind of interaction with the neighbors and some of the observations they made. What kind of response have you gotten from neighbors, and what kind of interactions and contributions have you received?
So, you know, one of our earliest thoughts about this program, because we knew before we were ever funded that it would be relatively expensive, not as expensive as it is to keep people in prison. I want to note that.
Yeah, $132,000, I think you said. Yeah.
So
I'm guessing you can come below that. Yeah,
exactly. So we knew it wouldn't be that expensive, but it would be costly to have the state support people in such a holistic way. But we knew that the only way for it to make sense is if we were having a program that was inviting and engendering a sense of community service to create that virtuous cycle, if you will, of the state and taxpayers investing in the success of these returning citizens and then paying it back. So part of the program includes our outreach and engagement opportunities, where we actually take our participants into the community to do all types of community service, whether it's, you know, cleaning up graffiti, cleaning up streets, feeding the unhoused population, what have you. And we've had some, you know, amazing things occur just in some of the simplest things, like taking our fellows out in the street to kind of clean up the trash. And you see neighbors joining us, people who live there, business owners who are joining our participants in the cleanup of a community in which we all live. So it's been really an amazing experience.
Did you have to navigate neighborhood pushback when the campus was being created? And, you know, I know in counties like ours, just a home with 4 people can get a lot of, you know, neighbors concerned.
Sure.
What was that experience for you like, and how did you navigate it?
So, you know, I think that this feeds right back into the conversation about like the social stigma, like, not in my backyard type thing. But that's a question about like how we are regarding like our community, like the people from our community and
who are coming back to
are coming back. Right. And it's so, yes, those conversations were had. We didn't have a lot of pushback because the community members understood the purpose of what we were doing. This wasn't just some dump off spot for people who had like distorted thinking and had a criminal background. This was an opportunity for people to really get a head start in their life, who had turned the corner, had the necessary support, and had made the decisions inside that they wanted something new for themselves, had gotten approved to be in this program, and were getting an abundance of support from an organization that was investing in their success. So they welcomed it.
Mm-hmm. I know we have people in our community who say, like, you know, these are our community members, and they're coming back one way or the other. This is where they live, and how do we want them to come back, and do we want them to succeed, and what does that mean?
Yeah, for sure. And you know, just going back to the example of like the Norwegian model, and how they do it in Europe and many places. Like it's a shared responsibility. Like these are our citizens, and we're contributing to this community. Like we can't just warehouse people. I think it's like one in 3 or 1 in 5 people have some type of criminal conviction or been to jail. That's a lot of people. So how are we regarding them, and how are we supporting them in being a contribution to this place where we all live?
Mm-hmm. The a little that I know about the Norwegian model, it also seems like there's a tension to the room that you're in, the physical environment. And you had mentioned the importance your organization plays in not just warehousing people and what it's like, you know, the place that they live. And so how have you all integrated that sense of how our environment shapes us and also the messages about one's dignity and humanity that happen through places and messages and, you know, offerings?
So, you know, one of the things that it kind of goes back to what I had mentioned earlier about, like, people want to be a part of something good. You know, it's also our responsibility as an organization, I would say as a society, to invite people to feel like they're a part of something special. Mm-hmm. When someone, you know, makes a poor choice and is put in an institution that, let's just call it what it is, like, prison was built to punish people. Mm-hmm. You've got, you know, two, as far as cells, you've got two adults living in a 6x9 closet. You know, I can tell you horror stories of 18-month lockdowns that I've succumbed to, not because I did anything wrong, but because I was in prison, right? That was my contribution. I was in prison and something happens on the yard, and 18 months in a 6x9 with another adult, it's not humane. So we knew that it was very important. It was critical to have a space where people felt like they were a part of something special, because they are special. We're all special, right? Mm-hmm. And none of us want to be defined by our worst choice.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So
how have law enforcement agencies, you know, kind of ones that are more local to Oakland or to other places that, you know, here we have the sheriff and RPD and APD, reacted to or engaged with CROP?
I have an amazing story to share with you.
Awesome. I love amazing stories.
I mean, I can give you some context. Like, here's the context. Here's the history. You
sure.
know, early on in prison, 99, 2000, it was like I actually have like vivid traumatic memories of literally being treated like an animal, like strip out, like all that, like your values next to nothing. I want to contrast that against something that just happened 2 weeks ago. So, you know, we've been doing some amazing work in developing partnerships with corporations. I had five members of an executive team of an engineering academy of a very big company who wanted to tour a prison. And so, you know, I reached out to the institution I paroled from, and they opened the doors. And, you know, from the lieutenant to the warden, the hospitality, the appreciation, and the narrative building that they're doing inside a prison, and they're adopting this new California model, was absolutely amazing and transformational. It was apparent that the staff inside were regarding the incarcerated population in more humane ways, that their appreciation for us, you know, not only CROP, but, you know, our partners to come in and ask questions and look for opportunities to partner together was abundant. So it was remarkable. It was really remarkable. And in the city of Oakland, you know, we have wonderful relationships with parole, probation, because they know what we're up to. They know what we're up to. And what we're up to is providing people with quality training and helping them on a positive trajectory for their future, which is good news for the community.
Yeah. Yeah. Which institutions are adopting the California model? Is it kind of a mandate for prisons or only some?
So San Quentin is like leading the way. Governor Newsom actually is launching, I think it's called the a rehabilitation center at that prison. But there are several institutions across California that are like increasing programming specifically for individuals who have made that transition and have said, I'm not with that life anymore. I want something new for myself, and I'm willing to go to this prison or this yard to receive ancillary programming.
So San Quentin's the model, and
that's where a lot of the money is going to go to this rehab.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it does sound like there's a need. So having spoken to someone else whose family member was there. Speaking of the state, you know, organizations like ours and other organizations are always looking at, you know, both on a local level, but kind of on a state level of changes that are needed. What are some opportunities for legislation or policy or things that we can do to push for, work for greater possibilities for equal justice? What do you see some of those changes that are needed?
So, I think it's pretty much in alignment with the work we're doing. Like, housing is big. People need a place when they are released. And it's not just like throwing five people in a room type housing. Like, are we treating people with dignity? Are we letting them know that they matter, that there is something more possible for their future by providing them with dignified housing? Training programs, like when people are coming out of incarceration, if they don't have the skill set, then, what do we expect them to do when they have to pay bills? Life is good and it ain't cheap. Mm-hmm. out here. So providing different types of training opportunities. And then obviously I really do believe that, any type of policy that is supporting the adoption of like fair chance hiring, where, people are actually given an opportunity. If they're the right candidate, don't let the choice they made 20 years ago preclude their opportunity from contributing to that organization. Like what type of policies can we have in place that really support people in having an opportunity to contribute?
I wanted to ask you earlier about your program, the sort of full case management. How does one become eligible for that? Of the people who are leaving and who contact you, how do you all determine who to serve? Because the need is great.
Yeah, so we do have a fairly rigorous application and selection process. But we have applications for people who are currently incarcerated. They're print-based applications that we mail in. People who are in the community, they can go to our website at croporganization.org and they can do it online. But basically what we're looking for is a few things, like that they have been making a good investment of their time, because we only have a year to provide them with the training. So there are an abundance of opportunities now, especially inside, to, pursue your education. You can earn a 2-year degree. In some institutions, you can earn a 4-year degree. How are you making use of your time, not only with your personal development and education, but how are you giving back? Like, are you participating in groups? Are you leading groups? Like, these are the individuals we really want to support with a very robust program. What the prevailing thought is that because we're currently proving this model, so the state can identify it as useful, and then, not only continue to support us, but support other organizations that are providing a holistic model. But once people inside begin to hear the stories of success out here, it'll contribute to changing the narrative inside.
Mm-hmm.
The 20-year-old kid who makes a poor choice today and is looking at 15, 20 years in prison can say, oh, I know there's another path forward for me. I can make investments right now in prison with some of these programs, my education, self-help, and then I can get into a program like Ready for Life or any other program out there that's being supported by the state to really equip me for success upon release.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it sounds like you're really like, is someone ready to take full advantage? Because, a year is great, but it's, for many people making big changes in their lives, it's quick. I mean, there's a lot you're packing into that year. So the more ready you are, it sounds like. So the state, you've had this money and they're thinking about continuing it. And, by training, I am a program evaluator. So we're always, when I'm looking at programs, we're always thinking, well, what is the sustainability, plan? Like how much is the state possibly ready to support? What else are you all looking at in terms of supporting programs like this?
Yeah. So, I mean, we also have, several partners in philanthropy, corporations that are also supporting us. But in my opinion, having been here from day one, like if you really want like sustainability and scale of a program of this nature, you need state buy-in. You need mm-hmm. the state buy-in. Mm-hmm. Because that's where real impact is made, through legislation and through like policy that's supporting programming like this. Our aspiration as an organization is not to be the whale. Like we don't mm-hmm. want to be the biggest fish. We want to be a salmon, right? We want to show the legislature, we want to show our partners, we want to show the community that this method of like a holistic program that really addresses a person on every level not only reduces recidivism, but helps to produce like responsible citizens and who are contributing to our economy. That way other organizations can mirror it in whatever type of training they're doing, but let's all get together and have a bunch of salmon that are providing really wraparound services for individuals who are coming out of incarceration.
Mm-hmm. I'm guessing if the state gave you that kind of influx of pilot money, there are not a lot of organizations doing this kind of intensive support. Is that true in California?
I think we're the only ones in the country doing what we're doing. I think it's a small number. If there's anyone else doing like our model, it's very small.
Yeah, they're underground. Well, we also look at, we're very aware of the state. We're pretty focused on Shasta County and what we can do here. And I know we're beginning to look at some of the statistics and what we might know from publicly available data about any inequities or, kind of leverage points. What have you learned over time about Shasta County, if you're willing to share, that are potential areas of concerns or areas that those of us who live here, might want to really explore and see how we can contribute positively to change?
I mean, that's a tough question. I say stuff like my mom still lives in Shasta County.
Uh huh. Mm hmm.
And I visit when I can. I'm currently in Sacramento.
Mm-hmm.
But I haven't lived there. I haven't lived there in, over 25 years.
Mm-hmm.
I do remember when I was growing up there that it seemed like, at least to my experience, there wasn't a whole lot to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so, thinking about as a teenager and in my like early 20s, as far as the different opportunities for people to constructively contribute.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if that's true still today. I do know that there's still pretty significant drug problem in Shasta County. Mm-hmm. So like this is an uninformed opinion, but like how would Shasta County be contributing to the substance abuse issues mm-hmm. in the county and the provision of opportunities for people to engage in meaningful work mm-hmm. in that county? I think that like that would be the top of mind, because like people typically resort. I know from experience, I suffered from a drug addiction in my teenage years in Shasta mm-hmm. County mm-hmm. to have up there off a hilltop. Right. So mm-hmm. I do believe that if people had some guidance and some opportunities in like meaningful ways to build their future, it would have a positive impact.
Yeah. Substance abuse treatment early and ongoing is certainly something that we see as really important. And I think that, the other thing we struggle with is, and I loved your framing at the very beginning, is, people talk about accountability a lot, and it's often for the other person, but that shared, like I'm accountable to what I do with my thoughts and my behavior, and society is responsible and accountable for how we treat people, opportunities that we we give. I forgot how you put it at the beginning. From a sociology perspective, we talk about, you know, limited life choices.
So like in Shasta, like for all of the people, not just the, you know, the leaders, it's like all the citizens, like how are we contributing to this community that is making it seem like a good choice? It's tempting people to think it's a good choice to, you know, be selling drugs, using drugs, whatever the case may be, involving themselves in criminality. And what could we be doing more as a community to present other options besides that?
Mm-hmm.
To involve them in like responsible ways of contributing to our community. You know, I don't know what it looks like. That's way above my pay grade. It's, you know, County's a pretty big county. But it starts with us taking a look at like how we're contributing to what is and what we could do to invite people to consider something new for themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that considering something new and having confidence that it's available to you, that you will have the support, that you can learn what it takes to get there. That seems to be another aspect, not just for people who are formerly incarcerated, but people who've grown up in poverty or people who have had other challenges within their families, maybe not poverty, but substance abuse or mental illness in their family. I mean, that confidence and support is super important.
Sure. And I would add this, you know, for me, you know, with 20 years of incarceration, you know, all the things that I was able to accomplish while inside, educationally, what have you, and even the success today, it wasn't because, you know, prison was super hospitable, right?
I've picked up on that.
It wasn't the razor wire that inspired me to transform my life. It wasn't the gun towers. It wasn't the early on years of being treated much like an animal that did it. It was the people who supported me.
Mm.
It was my mom. It was the community of incarcerated people who also wanted something more for themselves. Mm. It was the free staff who came in and believed that there was something more for us outside of the wall. It was the volunteers who came in and said, hey, this is possible for you. Like, it was the community of support that helped me to transform my life where I could come out here and provide opportunities for other people to do the same. And the same is true in the community, right? Like, I'm not saying that law enforcement is needed. Of course, law enforcement is needed. But what is the posture of our heart? What is the posture of our spirit as a community when it comes to people that are making poor choices? Like, are we surrounding them with support? Like, okay, you made this poor choice. We're going to have to hold you accountable for your choice, right? But we're also going to hold you in support in belief that you can do something more for the future.
It's beautifully said, Jason. Beautiful. You know, as we begin to wrap up, I like to ask people, what should I have asked you that I didn't? Is there anything that you've been thinking about or that's emerged while you've been speaking that is important to add here?
I think that, I think you asked a lot of great questions. The one thing for me that's gave me a little bit of pause, I think, and concern was like speaking to Shasta County when that's where I committed my crime. And, you know, I get emotional thinking about it because I think about all the damage that I contributed to back in 1999, and I can't go back. And a lot of people who commit atrocities, commit crimes, that like we can't go back and undo the harm. I think it's valuable to express that the one thing we can do is create a context of support around individuals who have made poor choices that inspire them to do what I've done, which is to live the rest of my life. The rest of my life is mm-hmm. dedicated to living in amends for that pain.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I do this work. That's why I have these conversations. that's why I continue to do the best I can to leave this world in a better place than I found it, and amends for that. So I wouldn't want that book to be lost.
Yeah, thank you. And it was really clear you shared that when you came to spoke, and also it was so clear to me that room was filled with people who saw how much you've done since, and all the good that you've brought to throughout the whole state through your work. So thank you so much for sharing with us and educating us, and for all the work you do, and for joining us for this conversation.
Thank you, Sharon.
When the war is won, we will be sure, we will be sure. Oh, glory,
glory, glory.
Oh,
glory, glory.
Hands to the heavens, no man, no weapon formed against, yes, glory is destined. Everyday women and men become legends. Sins that go against our skin become blessings. The movement is a rhythm to us. Freedom is like religion to us. Justice is juxtaposition in us. Justice for all just ain't specific enough. One son died, his spirit is revisiting us. True and living, living in us. Resistance is us. That's why Rosa sat on the bus. That's why we walk through Ferguson with our hands up. When it go down, we woman and man up. They say stay down, and we stand up. Shots, we on the ground, the camera panned up. King pointed to the mountaintop, and we ran up.
One day, when the glory comes, it will be ours, it will be ours. Oh, one day, when the war is won, we will be sure, we will be sure. Oh, glory,
glory, glory.
Oh,
glory, glory.
Now the war.
Every man, woman, and child. Even Jesus got his crown in front of a crowd. They march with the torch, we gon' run with it now. Never look back, we done gone hundreds of miles. From dark roads, heroes, to become a hero. Facing the League of Justice, his power was the people. Enemy is lethal, a king became regal. Saw the face of Jim Crow under a bald ego. The biggest weapon is to stay peaceful. We sing, our music is the cuts that we bleed through. Somewhere in the dream we had an epiphany. Now we right the wrongs in history. No one can win a war individually. It take the wisdom of the elders and young people's energy. Welcome to the story we call victory. The coming of the Lord, my eyes have seen the glory.
One day, when the glory comes,